as I say, today we are looking at something rather more, I think, complicated in a sense, certainly for those who are not scientific-minded like myself. The title we've taken is From the Ebola Virus to Antimicrobial Resistance, Do We Face a Global Health Security Crisis? And this is a question, I think, which we've been wrestling with for some time now. We're very lucky to have got to speak to us Jeremy Farrar, who is the director of the Wellcome Trust, which, as you know, is a global charitable foundation dedicated to achieving extraordinary improvements in health by supporting the brightest minds. Before he joined the Trust, Jeremy was the director of the Oxford University Clinical Research Unit in Vietnam, where his research interests were infectious diseases, tropical health and emerging infections. He's contributed to 500 peer-reviewed scientific papers, and he served on several World Health Organization advisory committees. He was made an OBE in 2005, and he's been awarded the Memorial Medal and the Ho Chi Minh City Medal by the government of Vietnam. I think that's something I would treasure if ever it came my way. But there's a lot of other things. He's a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences. I'm not going to go on because I don't want to embarrass him, but I'm going to ask him to talk to us, as usual, for about half an hour, and then we'll open it up to discussion and questions, and I will finish the meeting dead on 2 o'clock, as I always do, so that those of you who need to get away can get away. I'm going to ask Jeremy to talk to us.
Thank you very much. I know everybody starts a talk with this, but as a young child, actually, growing up in a very, very liberal background with a father from Huddersfield and a mother from Hebden Bridge, to come and give a talk here is a real privilege. And to be in this room, thank you very much for the invitation. And I hope the next 25 or so minutes will be of some interest. And I hope it'll stimulate some discussion. We scientists, which is what I am, often talk too much within our own communities and don't reach out sufficiently. So the collective wisdom of the people in this room would be very useful to tap into. And I think some of the comments I'm going to come to at the end, we face a critical time at the moment, I think, in many, many ways, in terms of our global governance. And I think I'd like to come back to that discussion at the end and perhaps open up that for questions. So yes, I'm very proud of the fact that I have both an OBE from the Queen and also the Ho Chi Minh Medal. I think I am right in saying I'm the only individual in the world that holds both of those two honours at the same time. And I won't say which I value higher. They're both, of course, I have huge gratitude for getting both. So I spent most of my life not in the UK, just a little bit of my own biography apart from the stuff you've already heard. I was born in Asia. I didn't come to this country until I was a teenager. And actually, when I first came, I came by boat. And that has very important ramifications for something I'm going to go on to talk about. I got on a boat in Asia, came up through the Suez Canal and arrived at Southampton Port some 6 to 8 weeks later. If I got on with the lurgy, whatever the lurgy might have been, I'd have probably died, or at least I'd have recovered by the time I landed at Southampton famous docks, and I would not have passed it on to the rest of you. That world has now changed. And yet many of our structures and organisations, nationally and globally, actually are not yet adapted to that world where things will happen in a much faster timeline and schedule. So I came to this country after having lived in across Asia and spent 7 very, very wonderful years, actually, although it seems odd to say this today, living in Libya, and so saw both an Asian and a Middle Eastern heritage, which has hugely influenced my own career and everything else. I trained in medicine in London, trained then in Edinburgh and San Francisco in neurology, and in the middle of a talk like this to a group of neurologists, decided that I didn't want to stay in neurology anymore, and I left for Vietnam thinking I'd be there for 2 to 3 years, and 18 years later, finally came back to the United Kingdom. So you're seeing somebody now who hasn't been in this country effectively for 18 years. I have to say, it is a much better country today than it was when I left, and I don't know if those two things are linked with my departure or not, but it is much better. It is more positive. It's more optimistic. It does have a more positive attitude, I think. And I know perhaps when you've been in this country all the time, you tend to see the overcrowding on the tube, whatever it is that you see every day. actually, when you step back from it, it is a better country today than it was when I left. So I spent my life in Vietnam, over 18 years living and working there, and I focused particularly on infectious diseases. And then about 10 or 11 years ago now, we were affected hugely in Vietnam by SARS. Now, SARS has sort of been forgotten about a little bit, but it's critically important to remember none of us have any idea where SARS went to. We've no idea where that virus went, why it came, why it disappeared. We don't understand its origins. We don't understand why it was circulating. And we effectively got lucky with SARS. Because of the way it was transmitted, it came to an abrupt halt. And in fact, the UK was, for some reasons that have never been clear to me, did not suffer, as far as I'm aware, a single case. But it was very nasty, and the impact on society in China particularly, and in Vietnam, and in Canada, was profound. And that really, for me, changed the professional look. And from that onwards, really, my focus was on emerging infections. And if we go back to SARS of 10 years ago, I say the virus, we don't know where it is today. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a treatment. We wouldn't know if there was a SARS case tomorrow how we would prevent or treat it. And that is a serious gap in our global security. I do not believe, although the current problem in West Africa is clearly a crisis, it should not be seen in any other regard, but I don't believe we're in an absolute crisis. I don't like terms like we're in a war on X or Y. I think we have to take a much calmer long-term view of these issues, because the inherent problems are not short-term. There may be short-term fixes to this or that, but tomorrow there'll be another issue, and I think we have to step back and take a much longer-term perspective. Of course, much of my work has been in the developing world, but the two subjects I want to talk about today, antimicrobial resistance and emerging infections, actually are part of the same issue. And globally, they are a huge problem. We forget, my mother's generation, my mother's hale and hearty, but she is, although she hates to admit it, in her early 90s. That generation were born in an era with no antibiotics. And none of, I suspect, anybody in this room knew that era. But actually, if you talk to somebody of my mother's generation, it was traumatic how many young children died. I was at the British Museum for breakfast this morning, a wonderful exhibit of mummies from Egypt. And you just look at the scans. If you haven't been to that exhibition yet, please do. Look at the scans, and as a doctor, you just can't help but notice the teeth abscesses, which probably led to their deaths because totally untreatable. We've forgotten what an important class of therapeutic agents these are. And, of course, they came about at a similar time that we were improving public health in the developed world, and we were also starting to implement vaccines. And those two things together, vaccines, public health, and antimicrobial agents, have had a profound impact. And we should not forget the impact they have had. As a young doctor here in London, I went through the start of the HIV epidemic in the early 80s. I was a junior doctor in St. Stephen's Hospital on the Fulham Road. That was an era when we saw 22-year-old, 23-year-old, 32-year-old, whatever it was, mostly male, young individuals coming in and dying of an infectious disease that we had no capacity to treat. That's within my professional working lives. The thought of HIV drug resistance should keep us all awake, not awake at night, because everyone deserves their sleep, but it should at least be at the forefront of mind. And within my professional life, which I hope will still got 15 or so years to work, that was in my own life, not some distant period. So the combination of vaccines, the combination of public health, and the combinations of antimicrobial agents has had a huge impact. And we've come to be complacent about that class of drugs. We give 80% of all antibiotics we give are given to animals. Although the European Union has banned that use, actually since the ban, it hasn't led to a reduction in antimicrobial use in various parts of Europe. And in North America, they're still massively used. So the human element of antimicrobial use is actually very small compared to the animal component. And the impact in costs, and I know costs are critical, even if you think beyond health, run into the billions in the developed world, and the impact on societies in the developing world are so significant. So, for instance, Thailand, which is not a low-income country, has more deaths than does North America in terms of antimicrobial resistance, purely because the levels of resistance are growing faster in some of those developing economies where they do not yet have the control mechanisms in place. You can get antimicrobial agents from any pharmacy on any street corner. And yet now people have got the money to start being able to afford them with no controls in place. And so what's happening in Thailand today, what's happening in the West Africa today, is of direct relevance to us tomorrow. And we should not disconnect ourselves from those issues. And on emerging infections, although we think of them today in terms of Ebola, because it's a critical issue and it's on the front page of everything, if you just look in 2014, we have a SARS-like virus circulating in the Middle East, and it has done for 2 years now. We don't know where it's come from. We don't know how many individuals have been affected. We have no vaccine. We have no treatment. We don't know whether what is happening in Saudi Arabia at the moment is what was happening in southern China before SARS broke out, where a virus has jumped across from an animal species, is learning to adapt to humans, and starts to then go between you and me. That's what happened to HIV in the 1920s and 30s. It's what happened to SARS 10 years ago. And we don't know if what's happening in the Middle East at the moment is going to lead to that. And the sharing of information and the sharing of data is still not where it should be. You may, and as well as so-called MERS-CoV, which is this new SARS-like virus in the Middle East, we have Ebola in West Africa, of course. We have major epidemics in small children in Southeast Asia at the moment called hand-foot-and-mouth disease, a new emerging infection, also now affecting North America. What we don't know is how many of these will go on to something big. We don't understand that species barrier between humans and animals. And sadly, the species barrier is not complete. Way back in time, of course, we share a history with primates, with other animals, and therefore there is a bit of that in all of us. And the chicken viruses out of Southeast Asia, like bird flu, which I was very involved in, and like SARS, still can find a home in us because we have some of those same proteins that originally came through evolution. You will all have seen the film Contagion, I guess, or at least you'll have heard of it. It's actually not that bad a film. And the truth is, and I was in the middle, and this is not, I was not seeking this, but I have been in the middle of SARS, I was in the middle of bird flu, I was in the middle of the pandemic in Mexico in 2009, and I've been very involved in Ebola. And I can promise you, in the early phases of those epidemics, it is really terrifying to be there at the bedside looking after patients when you know you don't have complete protection. And a very good friend of mine, Carlo Abani, the WHO representative in Hanoi, was the individual that stopped the spread of SARS in Vietnam. He realized in the hospital in Vietnam something odd was happening and a number of people were getting a respiratory infection and passing it on, a bit like that cough, to their next-door neighbor. And they were passing on to healthcare workers. And he made an unbelievably brave decision that he would close the hospital. And he persuaded the hospital authorities to not let anybody in or out. And in doing so, stopped the SARS epidemic in Vietnam. And as a result, Vietnam did not suffer other than that single hospital. And tragically, he lost his life with three young children at that time. And we all knew that, and we were all working in that environment. So when you see on your television screens just the bravery, and I don't include myself in this, but the bravery of those individuals on the Ebola front line today is absolutely to be respected, because I promise you it is very frightening. The other thing is the speed that these things happen. And if you don't intervene early, you really pay the price later if you don't act quickly. So we allowed SARS to develop too long in China. It did not admit in 2003 it had a problem. China's changed significantly today, and I do believe China would admit to it today. But what we're seeing in the Middle East at the moment, unfortunately, the Saudi authorities are not sharing sufficient amounts of information. In Ebola in West Africa, we knew that there was a start of an Ebola outbreak in January, and yet actually collectively, and I include myself in this, we did not respond until June, July, August. And even today, almost a year into the epidemic, you can see that certainly in Sierra Leone and in Guinea, the epidemic continues to rise. And that is a major problem. We have an ability to pick things up around the world now. And China has led this and should be acknowledged for that, a willingness to share. Surveillance is better. We will pick up drug resistance that's happening in Cambodia in a way that we would not have done 10 years ago. We will pick up Ebola is happening in West Africa in March, April of this year. So we are better at that. But what we have not done is worked out as a globe how we're going to collectively respond to that. So we've been passive We're better at picking things up. We do not have a global governance structure that allows us to act. And we certainly don't have a global governance structure that allows us to act decisively. So if you ask the question, pandemic influenza of 2009, which I appreciate many will see and have criticised, including myself, for overreacting, I can promise you in Mexico in March 2009, there is a square kilometre where there are four hospitals in central Mexico. And those hospitals, and I was there, were full and overfull. Every intensive care bed was full, every bed was full to overflowing, and they were all young people affected and pregnant women. And when you looked at that epidemic in 2009, it looked to all the world as if this was going to be a very nasty 1918-style pandemic, which, as everyone knows, killed more people than the First World War did. And you know how quickly you can transmit that around the world. You don't have to get on a boat to come to Southampton. You can be in Mexico 10 hours from now. And that ability to circulate. So when I saw Mexico in March, April 2009, it looked to me, I have to admit, that this was going to be that pandemic that we've all sort of been preparing for. Now, in retrospect, it's easy to say we overreacted, and I would be the first to step up and say, yes, that's true. But I would rather we overreacted occasionally than underreacted, which is what I think we're doing today in terms of Ebola. And I think we as a community have to have a thicker skin and just accept that we'll occasionally get it wrong. But even if I take influenza, which is one of those really nasty infections that really genuinely could do something of huge damage globally, the truth is Ebola will not do that unless it changes. Because it's very difficult for me to give you Ebola unless you see my bodily fluids, touch my bodily fluids. And that, to be honest, doesn't happen in social connections. But if that cough, again, in that corner, was a nasty respiratory infection, influenza, SARS, it will go to the next person on the tube. Because coughing over people and onto surfaces is how infectious diseases are easily transmittable. So a respiratory infection spread by coughing is the one that we should all most worry about. So flu is one I do worry about. But if you ask the question, after 2009, do we know which vaccine works and could we develop a vaccine within the next 12 months and deploy it globally? Ask yourself if you know how to treat a patient who comes to a hospital with influenza, and you'll have heard all the arguments about whether Tamiflu works or it doesn't work. Was the British government right to stockpile it, or was it not right? We haven't even answered those fundamental questions. So I think as a lay community, and when I talk to family members or friends who are not in the medical profession, and I say we don't actually have a vaccine that could stop an influenza pandemic tomorrow, and we don't know whether to treat and how to treat somebody with which drug, at which dose, for how long, to prevent them both getting complications, people look at you as if that's mad. And yet, actually, we missed that opportunity in 2009 to address that. And I think largely we missed it because of the over-regulated, complex structures that we've put around research, such that during an epidemic, we cannot conduct that critical research. Going on to Ebola now, we have managed the Ebola outbreak as if we were in 1976, when Ebola first arrived and was first recognised. 1976 in the Democratic Republic of Congo looked very different to West Africa today. People lived largely in village communities. They didn't travel very far. The average person with Ebola in 1976 spoke to 9 other people in their community on a daily basis. So you had to follow 9 others. In today's Ebola outbreak, in the capitals of West Africa, that's 125. It's bigger than this room. You cannot follow, you cannot survey, you don't have the resources to look after. So the thought that we can address the Ebola issue of West Africa today using effectively 19th century intervention measures of quarantine and washing hands and wearing a face mask, we have to combine 21st century medicine and science, and we have to bring that to bear with public health. And we have to combine these three together if we're going to be able to address the issues that we face today. So the two combinations of antimicrobial resistance, which is coming, and we shouldn't think it's only limited to infectious diseases, modern surgery, your hip operations if you've had one, or if you haven't had one yet, the chances are you probably will have one. Most of Britain over a certain age seems to have a hip operation or a knee replacement or something. You'll probably have to have surgery at some point. And that would become extraordinarily difficult if your risk of infection was higher. And surgery is based on a risk-benefit ratio. If it's very safe, you can do it to everybody. If it's not very safe, you think twice before you do it, so you don't go into it. Cancer treatment would be impossible without antimicrobial agents. Many of you will remember HIV coming into the Western world and the devastation it's caused sub-Saharan Africa. If we didn't have treatment today, and I honestly don't believe there'll be an HIV vaccine in my working life, and we're not going to change the behaviour of everybody, particularly in the way HIV is transmitted, you cannot stop people having sex. You just can't do it. It's just not possible. So you're going to be reliant on antiviral drugs to control the epidemic, and that's what has been the major breakthrough. We've turned round malaria in the last decade because of impregnated bed nets and anti-malarial drugs. Both of those are now suffering from drug resistance. And it's not just a health issue, because the impact on societies is huge if young children, if pregnant women, if people of working age are not at work, but they're off sick because of X, Y, and Z. So this has an implication not just in medicine, but the broader society. So I believe we're at this critical stage when we, over the last decades, have come to undervalue, in my view, global institutions. We've become, in many ways, more nationalistic and internal-looking. And although I am one of the biggest critics of the World Health Organization and the United Nations in their abilities to respond, I do think that we need some global governance of health such that we're not always reliant on, at the moment, the single superpower, the United States, and others, that we have some common ground and shared values that says health is an issue for all of us, because what happens tomorrow in Jakarta, or what happens tomorrow in Mexico, or in Beijing, or in London, affects somebody in the other continent, and will do, because there's massive movement of people around the world. And that drug-resistant thing that happens in Delhi is going to come to London and will come to University College Hospital or St. Thomas's Hospital. It's inevitable that the movement of people will allow that. So I think we have to get back to both respecting and supporting the global organisations, including the World Health Organisation. But we cannot do that, in my view, without reform of those organisations. They've become massively bureaucratic. It is true that the powerful countries of this world, which is largely countries within Europe and North America, I believe have deliberately sometimes thought to have weak leadership in those organisations. And I think if we want weak organisations, we should put weak leaders there. But if we want strong organisations, we should make sure the best people are there to drive those organisations. And I think ultimately it's in our interests to make sure those organisations are properly supported. So the World Health Organization capacity to respond to epidemics over the last 5 years has been reduced by 40%. The whole organisation has lost 30% of its funding. So we're not valuing these global bodies. I think we're becoming too insular and thinking more nationalistic, and we do have to be, I believe, thinking more globally. That can't happen without reform. The World Health Organization and the United Nations is not fit for purpose in its current format, and it needs to evolve. It's a 1947-48 organisation trying to deliver something in the 21st century. And I don't believe those organisations are able to do that, because the world has changed so much. So without reform, I don't think we will get to where we are. And that brings me back to this organisation, because your voices, the way you've structured yourself over the last, whatever it is, 132 years or so, your outward-lookingness and your willing to challenge the way we do stuff to say there is a better way is the reason why I was so happy to accept coming today and make sure that some of this gets across, and happy to take any questions and answers at the end of it, but making sure that we work together to try and change these things for the better, because I think they're critically important, whether it be to antimicrobial resistance, whether it be to emerging infections, and they're not something that happens to other people and not to us. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much. Yes.